Welcome to Give Theory a Chance. In this episode, Daniel Chambliss joins us to discuss his article, The Mundanity of Excellence, an ethnographic report on the stratification of swimmers, which was first published in Sociological Theory in 1989. This is also the debut of a new format which guests share life lessons that can be taken from their favorite sociological theory, or in this case, Dan's own research. Hi, Dan. Thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Kyle. Thanks.
Just to get us going, can you give us a short introduction or origin story to the research that led to your book, Champions, which was published in 1988, and then the article, Mundanity of Excellence, which was one of my favorite articles. I sign it every time I teach Intro to Sociology, and was published the following year, 1989.
Yeah, sure. It's pretty straightforward, actually. So long time ago, I was in high school, and I was into competitive swimming, and I loved doing it. And was real excited about the sport, and I worked real hard at it and learned everything I could about it and so on. But I never got to be very good, I thought, so that was kind of frustrating. And so there was always that kind of lingering issue of why wasn't I better than I was? And so flash forward many years, and when I finished graduate school, and now we're talking the early 1980s, I was looking around for a new project, was tired of the stuff I'd been working on, and for 1984, the Olympic Games were going to be held in Los Angeles. And I thought, what, I could go swimming, go study competitive swimming. And so I hopped on an airplane in early 1983 and flew to LA across the country, which I'd never done before, and I literally just drove to the pool where the best team in the world practiced and asked if I could just sit on one side for 2 hours and watch a practice. And they let me do that. And the next day, at the end of that day, I didn't say a word. I just leaned against the fence and kept a low profile. And at the end of that day, I asked the person in charge if I could come back the next day. And he said, well, we start at 5 a.m. And I go, fine. This was in January in California. And I showed up at 5 a.m. It was pouring rain. It was totally dark out. And I spent, long story short, I spent the rest of the week doing that, just sitting off to the side watching. Didn't say a word, didn't ask any questions, anything like that. I repeated that over the next couple of vacations that I had. You know, spring break, I did the same thing. Summer, I came back. And at a certain point, they basically suggested I study them, which had been kind of my goal anyway. But I wasn't interfering, and they felt like I whatever I was up to, I was real serious about. And I just told them I was a sociologist who studied organizations, and they said, oh, you should study us. And so I did, and that's basically how it came about. And then meanwhile, I was also coaching a really terrible team in upstate New York. We were terrible at the beginning. We improved a lot over the next few years as I learned how world-class athletes and coaches do their work.
So were you coaching, before you started the research rather than as
yes,
part of the research?
That is correct. Okay. That is correct. Yeah. I very part-time. I mean, I was, a couple hours, 5 nights a week in the evening. I was also teaching. I was also in my professor job.
This reminds me so much of the article in that your answer was very straightforward and accessible, but I feel like there are a bunch of lessons buried within it as well.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
So I'm curious when you have students who are earlier in their career, do you generally recommend that they research something that they have such emotional attachment and knowledge of?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to research something you love or research something that you have distance from?
Well, the good thing about researching something you love is you're real into it. You want to be there and you like doing it. I mean, the downside, obviously, is your perceptions of things aren't fresh. Now, for me, what was fresh was, yeah, I had been coaching, but I'd been working at a very low level in the sport. And so going off and living with Olympic class coaches and watching how they did things was just a huge shock. Like, it was very different than I expected it to be. And so there was that freshness. But you have to work at keeping it new and all. So there are advantages to studying something you don't know anything about, for sure.
One of the things I appreciate also about your article, and one of the reasons that I'm able to assign it in Intro to Sociology, is that you don't take a ton of time or give a lot of space to, here's all the many methodological debates that are happening, right?
Yeah.
It's not a negative reaction to other arguments. It's instead saying, hey, this is what I'm doing and here's what you can get from it.
Yeah.
And really, perhaps even more interesting considering where you published the article in Social Theory, you kind of do the same thing with theoretical arguments. You say, hey, here's what I did and here's what I learned from it, rather than saying, well, hey, here's all these arguments in the field that I have to engage in. Could you talk a little bit about that approach that you took, or if there were particular theorists or theory that you were inspired about, but you said, you know, I'm not going to give you 3-page summarizing this theorist or this debate.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's fun to do that, you know, if you're into sociological theory and you're talking with other professionals and all, I think most of the world doesn't care particularly, but that our theory ought to be able to make the real world more interesting and explain it and so on. So the theories that I really had in my background were basically what we might call classic Chicago school sociology. That's Howard Becker and Everett Hughes and Kai Erickson, who was one of my mentors, based on symbolic interactionism. So this was a whole school of thought that said what you need to do is go out and immerse yourself in the people you're studying and find out how they live and how they really see the world without standing back and just kind of judging them from afar or just collecting statistics about them or something. So that's part of it. The other part is certainly related, which is phenomenology, which was a branch of, it's a big word, branch of 20th century European philosophy. And I studied that a lot in graduate school. And it was basically a similar sort of approach, which is let's try to figure out how people organize their own experience of the world. How do they see it? And that underlies everything I've done in sociology. Is I'm just curious how other people can see, for instance, can think it's normal. In another piece of research I did, how do you think it's normal to amputate 4 legs in a day, which surgeons do all the time? There are surgeons who will amputate 300 legs in a year. And they think it's like a day at the office. So, which is not the way I saw it.
Yeah.
But, you know, how do you live that way? But in this case, it was Olympic swimmers and coaches. And what are they doing? How do they look at things so differently than I do? That they can be great at something.
Yeah, it's interesting. So was there any, and this is definitely more for the audience of those who are attempting to pursue research, was there ever any encouragement or push from the editors of the journal to have more of that?
Yeah.
Here's these debates within sociology. Here's what they're doing. Here's what I'm doing. Or were they pretty receptive to you saying, look, the goal of theory is to better understand the world and I'm helping you do that?
Well, I hate to admit it because this is totally atypical. The way that article got published in there was that a former editor of the journal saw it in rough draft and he told me to mail it to the current editor and say, publish it as is. There was no actual peer review on that article.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
And yeah, it was weird. Well, the American Journal of Sociology, which was, I thought, the highest prestige journal in the field, I sent it to them earlier, and there were 2 reviewers, and one thought it was great, and the other thought it was terrible. So they turned it down. But I thought, wait a minute, if there's a controversy about it that big, you know, the one thinks it's great and the other thinks it's terrible, I'm really on to something, you know, and I felt pretty good about it. So then I mailed it to a couple of basically famous people. So I was quite young at the time. I just held my breath and said, I'll just send it to these guys. And I did. And one of them said, this is terrific. I'm going to tell Social Theory just to publish it. And that's what happened.
Okay. Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into the actual article in even more detail. So you present us in the article with a way to understand excellence, specifically looking at the stratification and performance levels among competitive swimmers.
Yeah.
What are some of the key findings or takeaways from your research?
I would say they're not particularly special people. If you meet top-level performers in all kind of field and get to know them, I don't mean just, you know, like at a reception or on TV or something, but actually get to know them, you'll discover they're pretty ordinary people in a lot of respects and can be quite approachable or can be jerks or can be really nice. But for the most part, they're very ordinary people who happen to be exceptionally good at something. Now, what they're good at, it, that's unusual. But it's not because they're weird human beings or anything like that. So, and along with that is, it also seems to me, if you watch them over time, you will discover that their superior skills have been developed. They weren't born being great at anything. I mean, nobody, Mozart wasn't born being a great musician. He had to work at it a lot for many years and so on. And so there's, it felt to me as if the magic, you might say, of great performers kind of disappeared. Like I don't particularly care to watch the Olympics these days. And I did research on Olympic athletes and I know them well and all of that. But it sort of made me realize, no, they're fast swimmers, you know. That's about it. But that they also spend a lot of time on the fine details of their sport. So tremendously close attention to technique and training methods and diet and, you know, sleeping habits and all kinds of things. If you go, for instance, to an orchestra rehearsal, not a performance, go to a rehearsal, you'll be stunned by the attention to detail that they exercise in stuff that you and I can't even hear. I mean, we can't even notice that, you know, the bassoon was a little loud at that point or something. And yet they'll go through all of that stuff. So that's another big one. And then maybe what you're thinking about in the article is this idea of talent, is that the whole notion of natural talent at something, to me, I think is a pretty useless idea.
Yeah, can you say more about that? Because I'll say when I teach the article,
right.
Students follow along every step of the way, and that's the place where they give the most resistance.
Because, absolutely.
Yeah, it's always when you get to that point, because we're conditioned over and over to say those are the most talented people, especially when you're looking at sports.
They are talented in this, but what all that means is they're real good.
Yeah.
You know, and it means they're real good, and we don't know why. That's really what it means when we say somebody has talent. Like, they're great at this, and I can't see how they do that. But if you watch them in practice, and again, over long stretches, I mean, I spent 10 years on this research, you know. And so you watch people at all levels of the sport in swimming, which I also did, not just Olympic field, but really lousy swimmers, competitive swimmers, and people like I had been and so on. You see the differences, and the differences are the buildup of detailed skills and attitudes and things over many years. And then, so talent is just kind of a catch-all phrase for that. Now, it obviously, some people have more, let's say, natural ability. Like if you're a basketball player, it helps to be tall. I understand that.
Yeah.
But the thing is that talent only, in a sense, only really matters at the very beginning and very end of the process. At the beginning, it matters because, like, coaches are going to say, wow, you're tall. I could teach you to be a basketball player. So you get more attention. And at the end, it might be the difference between two really, really, really good athletes, let's say, you know, natural ability.
So talent's both. It obscures at the level of a method, right?
Yes,
because it doesn't give you.
Absolutely.
It gets in the way of, if you're talking about the basketball player, say that they're tall or that they have grace or things that you could actually point to and measure rather than to say talent, because it obscures.
There are a lot of tall people who can't play basketball well.
Yeah.
I'm here to tell you.
Right? Yeah.
So it's all the stuff in between that really matters. That is the develop. First, try to be good. You know, like most people never even try to be good at most of these things.
Yeah. So it's both, it obscures at both the methodological and the explanatory level. So really it has a very negative effect in a sense, because we can point to a thing and it obscures the thing that we're actually obsessed with.
Well, and it discourages people from working at something. So a problem I had in my competitive swimming career was I started out on a team and there were these guys, I went to a boys' school, who were just fabulous at it. And I'm like, oh my God, they're so talented. And I thought that was just a kind of built-in difference between us. And it took me a while before, well, something happened and I got a new coach. And within weeks, all of a sudden, I was competing with these people. And like, wait, what? Because the coach had taught me a few specific things that really make a difference. And it turns out life is like that.
So they had already learned those things, and you were just reading it as talent, which meant you don't have it, so you can never achieve it.
Yeah. I didn't see them learn it. Yeah. You know, I wasn't around when they had done it. Because in athletics, a lot of times it's a matter of having parents who were into that sport and would teach you things when you were quite young, so you have that early advantage. Yeah, it applies in everything. In academia, so I became a professor, but I don't know your background, but I grew up in a family where everybody read a lot. My parents were compulsive readers, and they taught us how to do that when we were very young. And my brothers and I all went into literary professions, you might say, and, you know, it just seemed like the normal thing to do. And that's, and other people go, oh, you're so good at this. Well, you know, it didn't just happen.
So looking back, are there parts of the argument that you wish you emphasized more or even less? But is there anything that you wish that you included in the article that you did not?
Well, as we were just saying, the clarifying the talent piece is something, because it always throws students. You know, you say talent is a useless idea and they get kind of upset.
Yeah.
So you have to explain that. The other, though, is I wish in the article I had talked more about how people develop these skills with other people. In virtually every field of endeavor, the best people have worked closely with other folks who are also very, very good at it. The way I think of it is join a great team. You know, if you want to get good at something, you've got to be in a setting where other people think it's valuable. I mean, if you want to be a good college student, you need at the least to have a friend who wants to also be a good college student. A study buddy, we would say, or teachers who are willing to spend the time and help you, or you go to a really good school and you're surrounded by maybe people in your department, you know, at a big university, maybe the whole institution, I don't know, people who think that reading stuff is important and writing is a good thing to do and it's good to think about ideas and stuff. You know, you have to be surrounded by other people doing it. So a social world. I would have emphasized that.
I like that point a lot, because in the way you were explaining why the group mattered, it wasn't, sometimes, especially with sports journalism, who you're around matters, because you get pushed by that other person who's excellent.
Yes.
But
yes.
The point that you're making also, correct me if I'm wrong,
is
that they value the mundane or boring things also.
Absolutely.
So that helps you not see it as boring or mundane.
Absolutely.
To show up at 5 a.m.
Yeah. No. They reinforce the idea that this is a good thing to be doing, that this is important, this is reasonable to be doing that. I mean, if you're a marathon runner, there aren't that many people in the world who think it's good to go out and run 10 miles every morning. I mean, there are a lot more than there used to be. Let me tell you, when I was growing up, marathoning was not a thing. And now a fair number of people do it. So you know there are other folks who think this is good. And that's crucial. It's also that, let's say in swimming, if you're on a great, and that's an individual sport, you know, swimming, you get up on the blocks, you're alone. It's not a team thing at that point. And yet all the best people come off of great teams. And it's because you're also surrounded by other people who can teach you stuff and who pick up little tips and tidbits and bits of information that might help, or somebody shows you how to do something, you go, oh, wow, maybe that'll work for me. Or you happen to meet the right person. You know, so it's that kind of support is really, really important. And if you don't have it, you can feel the difference.
Thinking of my experience in sports, if you're on the basketball team and it's time to practice free throws and everyone else on the team is saying, why do we have to do this? This is annoying. You're going to feel bad actually focusing on the detail.
That's right. And then you're the
oddball. If you care about it. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
You need to be surrounded by other people who take it seriously.
As I mentioned before, this is one of the motivations for having this iteration of the podcast. One thing that I like so much about your article, and I think sadly we don't do enough of this in our article writing, and even more in the classroom when we have that audience of students, is thinking about how we can take lessons from sociology that we can implement in our own lives, or that can provide guidance to our actions.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, looking at your article, and I know you've done this in some of your other writing, what are some of the lessons that can be taken from the pool to other places?
Yeah. Well, the first is the one I just said, which is, the way I think of it is, if you want to be good at something, join a great team. Put yourself in a setting where everybody else is going to think this is good. When I went out to Southern California from upstate New York, I was just stunned by how athletic the culture is. Everybody there was working out all the time. And I mean, it was just the thing they did. And they were all good at playing tennis and playing basketball and running and swimming and biking and so on. You know, this is not a thing in central New York. I mean, there's skiing, I'll grant you. But the athletic culture was a big thing. If you want to be a great dancer, you need to go to New York City. I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, the opportunities in the village I live in are just not that great. I mean, there are some people and they're good at it, but, you know, if you want to be great, you need to go where the great people are. That's part of it. I like to say, if you want to learn French language, you need to spend time in France. If you go there, suddenly you'll improve dramatically because you're surrounded by people who do it all the time. And so that's one thing, is move to a place or join a great team, something like that. The other, just at the individual level, is if you want to become good at something, you can get the information on how to do it, right? There are books on any topic you want. But you've got to practice, and you've got to practice with an eye toward improvement, not just doing things over and over, but getting better on a systematic basis. Breaking down the task and saying, okay, now I do this, now I do this, now I do this. You know, if it's playing your scales on the piano, or if you're drawing and you're trying to practice perspective, you know, there are things you do. And you just have to repeat them until you nail them, then you move to the next skill. So break it down into a series of steps and do them one at a time, and you will get better.
One of the points that you make in the article is that in your research, you found that it was qualitative changes that mattered even more than just quantitative changes.
Yes.
So much in popular culture, whether it's something like the 10,000 hour rule or just like the idea of practice makes perfect, we often focus on just more of that thing. Mm. I'm kind of curious how we could take your lessons from the pool, focusing on the qualitative, not the quantitative.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, even imagining the student who's listening, you know, they want to they want to do better in their classes.
Yeah.
What lesson would they take from that, that it's a qualitative, not just quantitative?
Right. Well, let me say the 10,000 hour thing, which you are taking from Malcolm Gladwell's book.
Outliers.
Outliers. Thank you. Is really borrowed from a psychologist named Anders Ericsson. Ericsson said it's not just doing 10,000 hours. It's 10,000 hours of what he calls deliberate practice. That is planned activity that's designed to systematically improve your technique. Okay? You've got to get better. You've got to make, as you say, qualitative changes that really improve your work. In the case of students, for instance, let's say I'm teaching students how to write, which I did a lot of. And, you know, if you say nonfiction, we're talking like an academic paper, okay, first, do you have a topic sentence for every paragraph? And we would spend 2 weeks on nothing but topic sentences. Their papers got better. And then we say, okay, do you have a thesis? Do you have a main point to the paper? Where is it? Underline it. Show me. And then we work on that. By comparison, in swimming, I would take the team I was coaching, and my assistants and I we go to a meet. We see how they do. We go, oh, everybody's backstroke turns were terrible. Okay, so for the next 2 weeks, we're going to do every day, we'll spend 20 minutes on backstroke turns over and over and over, getting them right until it was baked in, until it was a habit. Then we'd go to the next thing, say, okay, now we're going to work on how to finish. And we'd work on that. So it's breaking it down systematically into pieces and marching through those improvements. So if you're a student, I would say it really helps to have a good teacher who's going to be aware of that approach and try to help you with it. But you can do it on your own.
And it's not just, as you pointed out with the swimming example, it's not that you made the swimmers you were coaching have 3 back-to-back practices. It was still the same amount of practice time they would have had otherwise.
Yeah, sure.
But it's an improvement on how and what you do, what you do in the practice and what you're focusing on.
Right, right. But you've got to focus on something. You can't just go back and forth. One of the worst things people can do, like if you're doing free throws in basketball, as you say, at the end of practice, is just go through and try to hit
just take 1,000 of them.
Exactly. That's ridiculous. That's because then you're just drilling in bad habits.
It's telling the student who's busy, well, you need to pull an all-nighter. And it's like, they probably don't.
No, they don't. No, that's not the issue. That's not the issue.
Yeah.
What you want to do is focus on getting it just right every time you do it, like the free throws thing.
This has been a wonderful conversation. It's exactly what I was looking for this model of thinking about how we can take ideas from research. I'm curious if you have any additional thoughts, especially just related to this task of how do we read social theory when we're not someone who, obviously if your plan is to go to grad school and become a professor, read it with a more practical, pragmatic, like, hey, I want to see what type of argument I can build when I do my research, or who can I show is wrong. But if you're just, most students aren't going to do that. So when you're reading sociology, when you're reading social theory, do you have any thoughts on how we should engage in that task?
Yeah, I mean, the real trick is to see the relevance, is to try to always be looking for what's an example today, right now. What's an example of the thing that we're reading about. So if you're talking about interaction rituals, let's say, which is an idea from Randall Collins that comes from Durkheim originally, people get together in a group, and if they're physically close together doing something all in unison, like chanting or singing or something, they tend to develop strong feelings about each other. That's a basic idea. It applies everywhere. It applies to everything. So if you're a student, when you're reading something, try to figure out what are the main points in this argument, and then say, can I think of examples how that happens in my life? Make it so it's real to you. Because the great thing about sociological theory is it applies broadly. That's the whole idea. That's what a theory is you're looking for general patterns in human behavior. Why people get embarrassed about things, if you read Irving Goffman. I mean, that happens a lot, Or why do people conform? Why do people go along with a group even if they don't believe in what they're up to? It turns out there are good reasons for doing that. And people have studied this kind of thing. So you learn the general patterns, and then you can see that, I mean, the great revelation for me of sociology was stuff happens for a reason. It's not an accident. It's not an accident that some people are real rich and some people are real poor. It's not an accident that countries go to war over and over, even though everybody thinks it's a bad idea. It turns out not everybody does. But, you can study those things and find out why they're happening. And that, to me, was a great revelation my last year in high school.
If what we're reading in sociology is not helping us understand the world around us, then something's going wrong.
Yeah, then you're just missing the point, right.
And I'll say, I mean, even in terms of the challenge of taking lessons from one type of site and experience and bring it to another site. I'm a bad swimmer. I learned to swim in grad school. It's actually one of the best classes I took in grad school is Intro to Swimming when I was at University of Minnesota. But reading your article, I took your article and it helped me out in teaching. And when I was on the job market and without fail get some sort of question about your approach in the classroom, I would bring up the mundanity of excellence. And so you weren't talking about that. Yeah. No, it helped me get a job. So
Good. I'm glad. Yeah. That's great. No, it works. Yeah, so, it absolutely works in teaching.
Thank you again. I appreciate the conversation. I appreciate the article. And
my pleasure.
Great.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot. Good luck in the podcast. This is a real good thing to do. Good thing to do.
Appreciation goes to Jeffrey Gilbert for providing theme music, SUNY Brockport for providing financial support, and most importantly, on behalf of me, Kyle Green, thank you for giving theory a chance.